It's 8:13 now. Good morning. Well, as we reported, the new Camas Services Building finally opened this week, as well as a new Camas Valley branch of the Summit County Library. In the studio to tell us more about that, I have branch manager Lee Whiting. Good morning, Lee.
Hi, good morning.
So this has been a while in the making. You guys had a temporary location for, what, the last year or so, huh?
We did, and it was a small, constrained place, and all our books were in storage. We brought everything back out, plus we added a bunch more.
Okay, so what do we got now at the new library?
We have a brand new sparkling facility full of books, media of all kinds. We have a great tech lab. We have an auditorium, which will allow us to do lots of extra programming, have guest speakers, screen movies. In our tech lab, which is one of the focal points for Camas Valley, this is something that we've never had before. We have public access computers, 12 stations in total. Two of those are media stations, which will allow people to come in and do more creative things. We'll have desktop publishing software. We've got high-resolution scanners, CD rip boxes, VHS to video converters. We have that lab also will lend itself to us being able to deliver educational programming and tech programming. We received a generous donation from Park City Hospital, Intermountain Health, Google Chromebooks, which we'll use for kids programming, doing 3D printing. We received a 3D printer as a generous donation from Mirror Lake Diner. So lots of people in the community are very involved. We've got some great programming coming up, some partnerships with the Park City Film Series. Dual immersion program is going to be extended into the Camas Valley. Our first movie's coming up. It's Coco. I think that's April 26th. That's right.
That's a Thursday?
Yes, it is. It's a Thursday. All our calendars are online at the summitcountylibrary.com. Also, we will be scheduling Ferdinand the Bull in May with them. We have a dual immersion program sponsored by the Bessie Miner Swift Foundation from the Park Record, which is Cantamos. That will be offered starting next week on Wednesday afternoons. We'll have baby rhyme times, story times. We have an adult book club that happens every second Monday of the month. That's all our programming starts next week.
Yeah, so with all of the new technical stuff in there, do you have the staff that knows how to operate it all?
We have some staff. We're also seeking volunteers to help us with some of the programming. We're a growing concern, and we're working our way into it. I think that's an okay thing to do.
Yeah. And what, do people just go in and have to reserve those?
Most of the time, those stations are available. Mm-hmm. If you need to come in and use one, just come in. If you need a special time and want to make sure we have a station, yes, we can reserve that for you.
Yeah. Do you have the numbers then from what you saw before the expansion, and we'll be able to compare that in terms of those visitors?
We do. Mm-hmm. We know that we had a big dip as we went into our temporary facility. A few years back in 2014-15, we saw traffic of about 80,000 circulations for those years. We're hoping to get back to that. In this first week, which is a soft opening, we opened Monday, we've seen a ramp up in people coming to look and use the library. We're fully functional and available for your visit. Come on in.
Yeah, and I know Park City Library, after being closed for over a year and then reopening, I mean, they saw their numbers like double. It was crazy.
Yeah, it's quite possible we'll see that kind of surge. I've already noticed a bigger utilization in the few days we've been open. Our traffic was 60 on Monday. We sprung up to 420 on Tuesday. We were 460 people on Wednesday. I don't have yesterday's counts. I think we're doing really well.
Yeah, and people just really want to come by and
absolutely.
See it.
There's pent-up demand. Folks in the Valley have been waiting a long time, and I just want to extend a thanks to everybody in the Valley who's been so patient, as well as all the folks who've been really helpful, including volunteers who helped us do the move and get into place and get ready for this. We're really looking forward to seeing everybody back and bringing in some folks who haven't been before.
Yeah. And you've kind of named it as the Camas Valley Library because it's really intending to serve the Rhodes Valley, I guess.
We serve the entire valley, stretching all the way from Peoa through Oakley, Marion, Camas, all the way to Francis and Woodland. And honestly, we also serve folks from Deer Mountain and along the corridor between Park City and Camas.
Mm-hmm. And so anybody who has a county library card is able to check materials out?
That's right. A Summit County Library card that works in all of our system works in Camas as well.
Yeah. And I guess what I also found with the Park City Library, I mean, gone are kind of the really quiet, whispering days of our library youth. And they're really very interactive and loud. At least they're on the ground floor. I mean, it's okay to use
it. It is okay. It's a community location. The theory in public libraries these days is a third place. You have your home, you have your work or school, and then libraries are a community location where people can meet and engage in activities.
Yeah. Do you have some of those quiet, though, study areas
we
available?
We do. There are two small study rooms that are private. We have another room that lends itself to meetings with about 14 seats in it. And then there are some quiet reading areas in the adult area. And in the young adult area, we have a couple of booths for kids to sit and collaborate. There's some whiteboard space there where there's a dry erase wall, and there's a nice big table. We have a game collection in that part of the library, so kids, back to your point about a little bit noisier perhaps in parts of the library, but there are also places where you can retreat and take refuge and sit down and snuggle up with a good book.
Yeah. So what are the hours of operation?
We are open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 7. Fridays, 10 to 6, and Saturdays, 10 to 2.
Okay, so no hours on Sunday at all?
No, we're closed on Sundays.
Okay, anything else you want people to know about it?
I just really want to thank all of our sponsors, and also please look at the Friends of the Summit County Library site. They are still seeking donations to help us with some of the expenses in our tech lab. They are $17,000 towards their $30,000 goal.
Okay. Yep. They, I guess, provide all of that unbudgeted stuff that
they
did.
That
you can use.
That, mm-hmm. that fundraising really allowed us to have the tech lab we have, and there are still needs that we have not yet addressed, including some programming for computer coding clubs and for adult online education using the Lynda programming, which is an excellent way for people to learn new technology.
Yeah. How big is that auditorium?
The auditorium is 60 to 100 seats. It has a flex space with the senior center, so depending on who's using which half of the room on which days.
Okay. Hey, Lee, thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Lee Whiting is the branch manager of the newly opened Camas Valley branch. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:21. It's 8:30. Good morning. Well, in the studio with a recap from last night's meeting, Councilmember Lynn Peake, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So
happy
got,
rainy morning.
You've got a couple of months now as a council member on your belt. How's it going?
Well, it's really exciting and interesting. And, you know, I think for me, because I was so familiar with a lot of the topics, the biggest thing for me now is finding my voice, which, as you know, as a person sitting on the other side of the table asking the questions, that's what we're used to. But expressing our thoughts and opinions is something that, you know, it takes some getting used to. It's kind of a freedom of expressing, you know, your thoughts.
So any surprises with the job?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Yeah, in terms of the workload, the commitment that you've made, the...
Well, I think that it takes me probably longer to read the packets because I'm not as efficient as maybe you learn to be over time. You know, it's easy to go down a rabbit hole. And so it's taking some time. The thing that I'm really finding is these council liaison roles that we have with different boards and commissions around town is really valuable. And I think it really keeps us out in the community in a way that you know, you've been before if you've been ever been on a board or commission, but this is, you know, more specific. And so I really enjoyed that. I went to my first RAB meeting the other night and just went, wow, this is a great board to be on and does great work in the community.
Mm-hmm. So the other boards that you served on, Mountain Trails Foundation, do you remain on that board or do you have to step aside?
Well, I was no longer on that executive board. I had let go of that about a year ago, but I still am an ambassador. And so that's something I'll just keep doing. It's kind of a fun involvement thing to, you know, keep doing what I like.
Yeah. So what boards do you serve on then with the
council? So, oh gosh, I hope I can remember them all. So I'm on the Friends of the Farm. I'm on the RAB board. I am really excited to be working with the Mental Health Alliance Steering Committee and also the Communities That Care Steering Committee. And then the HPCA, since that was sort of what I was working, the Historic Park City Alliance, I was working with a lot of the Main Street merchants in my previous role. It kind of made sense for me to stay as the council liaison to that group. And I'm really happy to do that.
Okay, let's talk about some of the issues. The nightly rental study, is the city going forward with a second phase?
Yes, we are. And boy, this information it's complex and it's interesting. And, you know, it's a little hard to, because we looked, Brumby looked at, you know, the county as a whole and then sort of broke different things out through the city. It was hard to follow the numbers and the statistics. But I think the overall, the overarching goal that we have here is to say, you know, look, you know, we have a lot of people out of compliance. You know, why is that? Is it because they're doing nightly rental in a neighborhood that doesn't even allow nightly rentals? We saw a lot of fudging between the, you know, the real address of a place that you might find when you go to Airbnb. Those are kind of disguised, I think. And so, you know, what are the reasons for that? Is it because they're in a neighborhood that doesn't allow it? Or is it because they're not paying their property tax? And, you know, if you have a nightly rental, property tax is 100%, just like for a second homeowner. But if you have a long-term rental or a primary, as we know, it's 55%. You know, what are those reasons? And what can we do to both, you know, as Michelle Downard was saying, bring people into compliance? There's some thought that it may just be an education. Like, you, people don't know they have to do fire and safety, health and safety for nightly rentals. But we also want to look at, and I'm really, because of our critical priority of affordable housing, want to really look at incentivizing people to keep long-term rentals. Because if you're doing everything right, it is a hassle to have a nightly rental. You have to manage it. You have to, you know, pay more in taxes. You have to do these things that you don't have to do with a long-term rental. And then we keep more in our pool for affordable housing. So I don't know what that'll look like, but I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Yeah. So, I mean, just give me an idea. I mean, when you talk about incentives.
Well, I don't know what it could look like. You know, I'm thinking, if I am someone who thinks, okay, I have this condo, I'm going to do nightly rentals. Gosh, if the city were able to give me a grant, say, for, a certain amount per year to keep that as a long-term rental. Now, it could get into a whole can of worms with enforcing that. You know, how do you enforce and know that someone's got a long-term rental?
Yeah. And then, as you mentioned, you know, we've got the homeowners associations that prohibit any kind of rental short term. The city has always said, though, it's not going to get involved with the homeowners association. So whose problem is that to?
Well, right. Yeah. And that's a difficult one because the HOA, the codes and covenants always trump. You know, if they're stronger and more restrictive, mm-hmm. they trump the city ordinance. So it's a big can of worms, and I'm really glad that we're doing this both with the county and the chamber and the city.
Yeah. So what about the those who rent out their homes to seasonal workers? Is that different? Is that short? I mean, what constitutes short term?
Short term is anything less than 30 days.
Okay. Let's see. Social equity. What's the next step with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, thankfully and happily, we'll be inviting Kilo Zamora back. I think I heard the mayor say we want to have him back for a study session, you know, every month for a while. He has a lot of great insight. And the biggest thing that he said to, you know, he talked about the city not calling itself a leader on this, but a convener. And, you know, we've talked about this before. We want everyone at the table. We want all of the groups that may consider themselves underserved or that we might think of as underserved. We want them at the table because we want to know their issues. We can't know the issues by imagining up what they are. But that's how, you know, we hope to move forward on this, is to include everyone in the conversation.
So who is this guy? I mean, and what does he know about
it? What I should have brought his bio, but he has worked he's worked a lot with the University of Utah. He's taught at the University of Utah, I believe, and he has done just a bunch of work around social equity over the years with corporations, institutions, you know, educational institutions, and he has come up to the leadership class every year, once a year for the last maybe 13 or 14 years. Miles has gotten him up here to just kind of illuminate what social equity is, and to make us realize what we have when we have privilege that we don't even realize that we have. And so, you know, just bringing a lot of awareness to the question.
In work session, you discuss some possible land management code amendments to deal specifically with affordable housing. So what direction did you provide to planners?
Well, we want them to – we like what they brought to us so far, and we want them to continue in the direction that they're going. And so this was a tool to encourage private developers, perhaps, that have not used the tool at all for affordable housing MPDs, which would in the past have required 100% of a development, an MPD, be affordable. And so this reduces that requirement to 50%.
It sounds like the city would be one of the first beneficiaries of some of the changes, especially the parking one. So is the city moving forward with Woodside Park before these amendments get approved? Or?
Well, Woodside Park Phase 1 is already, you know, it wouldn't be part of that, and it's already designed. And that was a question that we had last night. What would Woodside Park Phase 1, how would it look different if this change in land management code had come before the design of this? And what we're looking at is, you know, a couple density increasing in a couple of ways. One is reducing the parking requirement, like you say, and the other is reducing the green space. And the conversation last night was, you know, how do we more efficiently use our green space so that it's still you know, so it's still usable green space and valuable green space, but it doesn't have to be so much, so that the development would just pencil out better for private developers or for the city or for something like a Mountain Lands community housing that might be building something. Because really, you know, the bottom line is no private developer is going to do an affordable development because it doesn't pencil out. So you have to give them some incentivization to help
make
that
money
along. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when you decrease the parking, then do you then have to add, you know, I guess limitations to those who rent them that they don't have a car?
Well, this is, I think, a big question, and it's a big conversation that will come. You know, what happens to the surrounding neighborhood when people are now, you know, they're going to have cars? For now, we think we're moving towards you know, a society that's carless someday, but how close are we to that, and how much is it going to you know, is the neighborhood going to have to bear the brunt of that until then? So that's still a question that we need to get worked out. I know some of these places will have a certain number of parking spots, and they'll lease those or rent them to the tenants per month. So you're sort of incentivized, maybe by the stick, to not have a car at all.
Council had about $2 million, more than $2 million worth of water projects before them. You approved both the $1.6 million
the Three
contract,
Kings.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then the other almost $700,000.
Right, and those are for the water meters. Those were on the consent agenda we did, and wow, you know, looking at those numbers, it's expensive to bring good water to this community.
Yeah, the $1.6 million, it sounded like it was just to design the treatment plant? That just seems like, and we haven't even put a hole in the ground yet.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, no, it was for more than the design, but overall, that project is, I want to say it's on the order of $4 million or something. It's a big project, and as you know, we've diverted the water away from, or we've allowed the water to flow down Poison Creek for what four or five years now. Because we cannot use it. We don't have adequate treatment for that water. And, you know, remembering when they put the pipes across to run over to Spiro to, you know, with the thought in the future of building this treatment plant, it's something that it's a big project, a lot of money.
And finally, I want to just mention that you did get an update with regard from your environmental sustainability team. Any takeaway from that?
Well, I think, you know, there's been this question circulating about, you know, when you have an electric bus fleet, you are, and you look at Rocky Mountain Power's current portfolio, it is, you know, highly coal powered, right? And so I think there was this question about, doesn't that increase a carbon footprint if you're running electric buses? And the answer is, in the short term, yes, it does, but it's not by the percentage that I think someone had figured out in the community. It actually, in the meantime, for maybe about another year before Rocky Mountain Power gets more renewable into its portfolio, it's about a 2% increase. And actually, if we had stayed with diesel buses, it would be a 4% increase in our carbon footprint. So even though they're, you know, quote unquote, coal powered now, it's still saving us 2% of the carbon footprint. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, except that we wouldn't be running the Electric Express. So I'm guessing, are you saying that if we would have used diesel buses for the Electric Express?
Right. Well, I mean, there is the certain, we have created new routes. We've with the Electric Express, we've expanded our fleet and created new routes. So there is going to be more carbon footprint in doing that. But overall, yeah, if you were to have run diesel buses on that Electric Express route, it would be 2% more carbon that we're putting into the air, essentially.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
Well, we just want to give a huge congratulations to Councilmember Becca Gerber, and she has got a new little bundle of joy. And I think we were all on pins and needles waiting, and he's huge and he's healthy, and we're just really excited to see him, and a big congratulations to her.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:43. It's a local news hour on KPCW. Well, Park City resident and World War II history buff Glenn Dyer, known to many as Duffy Dyer, has published his first book, Torch Betrayal. He'll be holding a book signing at Dolly's tomorrow night, 6:30 p.m. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, I'm well, thanks. So as a former general manager of Fox, both in Salt Lake and Washington, D.C., it sounds like you have spent a lot of time free reading and researching since retiring rather than watching TV?
Yeah, actually, even before retiring, I've always been fascinated with history, and in particular the years of World War II, and have collected books, both fiction and nonfiction, and I've just been mesmerized by how cataclysmic that whole event was. And I keep reading, and there's so many stories that still keep coming out, little known stories, and I'm just been fascinated with that period.
Yeah, well, that was one of my questions. I mean, just looking at the Academy Award nominations this year, we had two World War II films, you know, The Darkest Hour and Dunkirk. I mean, why is it do you think that this war is so rich and full of stories? I mean, we just keep hearing about more of them, as opposed to like Vietnam.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think that the death toll, which is, you know, around 50 million people, dozens upon dozens of countries that were involved in some way or another, even countries that were out of the conflict, like Switzerland and Spain and Portugal and Sweden. All of these countries are still immersed in this war. They, you know, a lot of those countries were hotbeds of espionage and spying and so on. And I think that a lot of the decisions the Allies made during and towards the end of the war, we're still living with a lot of those decisions as far as how countries were, you know, the borders were redefined and taken over as part of deals that were made. But you raise a good question. What's the difference between that and Vietnam? It certainly – World War II was a war that the United States, everybody got behind in one way or another. Everybody knew somebody that served and even people back home did their part, buying war bonds and saving scrap metal and victory gardens. It was just a very different time.
So the book, it's historical fiction. Can you give us the Reader Digest version of it?
Sure. I stumbled upon in my reading, I stumbled upon something in a book written by Eisenhower's naval aide. And in this book, he states that a top secret document that came from the combined chiefs through General Marshall that contained the directives of Operation Torch, all of the key information concerning the invasion. This document went missing. And in his book, he never states that this document was found. And it piqued my interest to such a degree that I built a story around what happened to this document. And what perplexed me was that if a top secret document with all of the key information about an invasion goes missing, maybe you should think twice about launching the invasion because that document may have fallen into the wrong hands. So since the invasion did happen and did occur, something must have been discovered as to where that document was. So I built a story around what happened to it.
Now, so because it's fiction, I mean, how much latitude do you have in writing about historical events?
Yeah, it can be very tricky. Historical fiction, you have to be very, very careful about pushing creative limits. You can't take an historical figure like General Eisenhower and make him into something he wasn't. But yet you do have some latitude as to, what words you have him say. You have to sort of stay in character to a large degree. And yet that was the fun part was weaving fictional characters with historical characters and having them interact. It was just a lot of fun to do that. But there is as a writer, there is a responsibility to not press your limits.
Yeah. I was going to say, so you've done, it sounds like, lots of research, and that was probably a lot of the fun part, but then you actually had to sit down and...
You know what? You actually have to tell yourself, okay, let's cool down on the research. You know, you're having too much fun. You got to start writing this thing. And because the research part of it can be so much more fun than, banging out the words every day. So, but you're right. Yeah, you eventually have to tell yourself, let's get to the task at hand.
And that's what you kind of told yourself. This is my job.
Yeah.
And I've got to
put
a few hours into it every day.
Every day you have to get your rear end in your desk chair and you just got to go at it. So.
Yeah. The book is self-published because it was easier to do that or?
Yeah. The publishing industry is a tough one to crack and, you spend some time seeking out ways to get traditionally published. And thankfully these days, if that isn't happening in the proper time frame, you can just take it on yourself. And it's a whole new business. It's a fascinating business out there. And but even if you were published with a traditional publisher, you still have to do a lot of your own legwork from promotion and marketing and such. But So there are hybrid authors out there who do both traditional publishing and self-publishing, and maybe we'll head in that direction. We'll see.
Okay. So you're going to be at Dolly's tomorrow, 6:30?
Yes.
Signing books?
Signing some books and answering some questions about how it came together and the writing process, and looking forward to that very much.
And you've got a sequel in the works.
I am. I'm working on it, and I'm actually quite excited about it. I'm taking the character in the Torch Betrayal, Connor Thorne, and going to take him back a few years before so that the readers can see how he came to be. And so going to center the whole second book around the 1939 New York World's Fair, which was a fascinating time. So,
well, yeah, did that come to you as you were writing this?
You know what? I was fooling around with some other ideas, and I came across some information about King George VI's visit to the fair. And I also came across some interesting information about the IRA's bombing campaign in England in 1939. And it just seemed like there's a story there. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, good luck with the first one.
Thank you very much.
That's Glenn Duffy Dyer and his book, Torch Betrayal. Again, he'll be at Dolly's Bookstore tomorrow. Well, on Tuesday, at a very familiar location but off-center court, NBA All-Star Mark Eaton released his new book, The Four Commitments of a Winning Team. It was during the Jazz-Lakers game. The two-time NBA Defensive Player of the Year and Park City resident, Mark Eaton, joins me now in the studio. Now, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. What a great spot, right, to launch the book. How did that go?
It went really well. It was good timing, and fortunately the Jazz are playing very well right now, so we had a great evening, and it was a great place to kind of get things kicked off.
Yeah. So some of the Jazz's best years, of course, when you were playing for them, and your years on the team between 82 and 1993. Was this where you got the material for your book?
Well, it's really a larger time frame than that because it starts when I became a basketball player at 21 years old, when I was working as an auto mechanic in Southern California, and a junior college coach convinced me to give basketball another try. I was not successful at it in high school. And this coach showed me some things about basketball that I didn't know. So the story really begins there, and my journey of going through junior college and then going to UCLA and coming to the Jazz and a little bit beyond the Jazz, along with the people along the way who showed me what I needed to do next. And that's really where the four commitments came from, was at each step of my career, something interesting happened that inspired me to get to the next level. And so it's a combination of that and then business stories from just being out on the road the last 10 years speaking to corporations.
So, as you titled it, The Four Commitments of a Winning Team, as you say, it didn't apply just to basketball. It's kind of life's lessons.
Well, it is, because as I've been out speaking to organizations, I've found that a lot of the commitments that I used as a basketball player apply, and there's some direct corollaries to business. And so a lot of people in business use the term teamwork, and yet I don't think they really always understand it from the inside out. And I had the advantage of playing team at kind of the highest level. And so I take those insights and look at internal competition, things like that, and how to get rid of that, and how to get your organization aligned and everybody committed.
So, do four commitments sum it all up? Or could it have been 10? Or did you have your 7-4? I don't know. Is four special to you?
No. Well, I think what I've learned over the years is that most people can remember 4 to 7 things. Like, once you start getting into 10, 12, 15, like, you know, people just glaze over. Four things are simple. Two of the commitments are more individually oriented, and two are a little more corporately oriented. And so it really starts with you, about understanding what you do well out there in your field or on the basketball court. Commitment number one is called knowing your job, doing what you're excellent at. And I share an interaction I had with Wilt Chamberlain one day in a gym in the afternoon at UCLA. And it changed my life in terms of my focus of taking me from just this guy who was a basketball player to somebody who could really focus on one aspect of the game and excel at that. And so it's really kind of about narrowing your focus and intensifying it. And I can keep going until the other ones are.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that your former teammate John Stockton, another Jazz great, wrote the foreword for you. Mm-hmm. He called you one of the very best teammates he had ever had. That is an incredible compliment, I think. I mean, so he was pretty willing to do this. And talk a little bit about why he said that. I mean, what is it that you think you've provided as a teammate to him?
Well, the one thing I did well on and off the basketball court was I protected my teammates. So my job on the basketball court was to protect the basket and give my teammates the chance to go out and try and steal the ball. And they knew if they missed that I would get between their man and the basket. And so I always had their back. And I think John – and that was something not only did I did on the basketball court, but I just did intuitively at the same time – And I think John felt that when he first got to the team, that we bonded right off the bat. And neither of us knew, you know, where our careers ultimately would end up. I mean, who knew that John Stockton would end up in the Basketball Hall of Fame, all-time leader in assists and steals in the history of the NBA. But we just sort of formed that bond, and it was a bond like that, that with all the rest of the guys, too, that really made our team great. And he was part of something at the very beginning where we went from one of the worst teams in the NBA, losing money, bad market, to 20 consecutive playoff appearances over the next 21 years. And so I think that kind of codified or, you know, created that kind of intense rapport out on the basketball court and as a friendship that, endures today.
Yeah. So talk to me a little about the writing process. Is this your first book?
It is my first book. It's taken many years to get done. It's a stop, start, work with this writer a little bit, work with that editor a little bit. And ultimately, it was my wife, Terry, who helped me get it over the finish line last summer, who just said, come on, let's get this thing done. And we found the right people, the right teammates to kind of help us finish it up. And then a good buddy of mine in Salt Lake, Richard Paul Evans, who's a 38-time best-selling author, gave me a little coaching about how to get through the publishing, editing, formatting, cover design process to really create something that I think is very great looking and a great read, and get it over the finish line and out the door.
Yeah, yeah, and you know about hard work. I mean, this is just another example of. Right?
Yeah, it took a lot of hard work, but then you also, having not done it before, it's a process to figure out, like, well, you know, how do we put it together? How do we make it flow? How do we balance my stories versus the business stories and make it readable and enjoyable and flow well, along with all the technical parts of just getting the physical book done.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, you're going to be at Dolly's tonight. There's going to be a big crowd on Main Street, so maybe they'll stop by.
Yeah, Dolly's tonight at 6 o'clock, so right after the parade's over. So, come by and see us at Dolly's, and they've graciously allowed us to hang out there for the evening. And so we're going to be signing books and saying hello.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've gotten some good feedback from it already.
I have. I've had some great friends of mine do some great testimonials for me as well on the back, so far, the reviews are looking good, and everybody seems to enjoy it. And ultimately, the long term plan for the book is that the people that I go out and speak for, I speak 60 or 70 times a year around the country, and those conferences and associations I know will also enjoy having a little book to go in the swag bag when they bring Mark in to speak. So
great. Well, congratulations.
Thanks for coming in this morning. Appreciate it. Thank you.
That's again Mark Eaton and his new book, The Four Commitments of a Winning Team. He'll be at Dolly's.